We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show, hour number two. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this hour, Focus, we'll be talking about depression. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, depressive disorders affect nearly 19 million American adults every year. And in recent years, rates of depression in children have risen significantly. So this morning we'll try to ask some basic questions. How it is we account for these numbers, what we know about depression and what causes it, how people with depression are best helped, what place should medication have in a treatment plan, all of that. And we're certainly open to whatever questions that people who are listening have. Our guest for this morning is Dr. Ronald Pies. He is a physician and a psychiatrist. He's professor of psychiatry at the State University of New York Upstate Medical University. That's in Syracuse, New York. He is also clinical professor of psychiatry at the Tufts University School of Medicine and is the editor-in-chief of Psychiatric Times. He's joining us this morning by telephone as we talk. Questions from listeners are welcome. There are a couple of numbers that you can use. First of all, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. Toll free. Well, we have toll free line, so it would be a long distance call. Use that. That's 800-222-9455. We also have email, so you can send in your comments, questions that way. It's will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, will-talk at illinois.edu. So at any point here, people who are listening, you're welcome into the conversation. And Dr. Pies, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Doing well, thank you.
Good. Well, we appreciate you talking with us today. It's certainly the case that much more today than in the past, and you know, we might have to go back a little bit, but certainly now people are much more willing to talk about depression. It is something that gets a lot of coverage in popular media, certainly there are all kinds of conversations about all kinds of things, and certainly a lot of talk about medication and is it good or is it not, and so forth. But I suppose whenever you come to something like this, that where you see a big increase in people's willingness to talk openly about this, you have to ask this question: well, do we? Is the incidence of depression actually going up? Do we have more depressed people, or are we just more open in talking about it than we used to be?
Right. Good questions. May I call you David?
Oh, yeah. Yes, sir.
David, I think it is true that if you read the news reports, it looks like depression is just everywhere. And one of the problems I think we have is that the word depression is used so loosely that it can become almost meaningless. I'll come back to that point in a second. But let me just say briefly that if you look at the most careful epidemiologic studies that have been done where trained screeners actually use very strict criteria for defining depression, the actual incidence or prevalence does not really look like it's going up very much, although possibly among women there may be some modest increases if you look at the most careful studies that have been done in both Scandinavia and in this country. But overall, if you look back 50, 60 years, the rates of significant clinical depression have not really changed that much. What we're getting are changes in how often the diagnosis is put down on a patient's chart. We're getting some increase in how often antidepressants are being prescribed, and there are reasons for that that we can go into.
Well, let's come right to that then, because it seems to be one of the most controversial points.
Yes.
That some people think perhaps we're over-medicating.
Right.
Some people think that actually, not that we're under-medicating, but that there are people who could really be helped by medication who are not on it. And then you sort of get into questions like, well, okay, you're going to write a prescription to somebody, but if you're really going to provide them a kind of complete care, you can't just hand them the prescription and wave as they go out the door and say good luck.
Right.
You know, it gets so complicated. So maybe a basic question is, well, what is the place of medication? What should its place be in a more total program of treatment?
Right. Well, the short answer to that is that medication alone should probably never be the sole approach to clinical depression, to serious clinical depression, almost never. And I've certainly, in all the years I've been in practice, which is almost 30, I've never recommended just taking a medication for somebody with significant clinical depression. If I might, though, let's go back just one step and try to get a kind of rough and ready notional definition of what depression is.
Okay.
You know, people tend to use that word very, very loosely. Oh, you know, I had a bad day at the office. I'm so depressed. Or I just broke up with someone and I'm really, really depressed. I mean, generally, when people say these things, what they mean is that they're sad, they're sorrowful, they're bummed out. But when psychiatrists, psychologists, and other mental health professionals talk about depression, we mean something really quite different. We're usually talking about what is called major depression or a major depressive episode. That can be part of either what we call unipolar depression or bipolar depression. We can come back to that. And this is a very, very different condition than sadness or sorrow or grief or just having a bad hair day. I mean, we're not talking about that. So when you talk about medication, you really have to be clear what it is you're treating, and we can, you know, come back to that as you wish.
Well, this leads to a number of other questions, I guess. You know, given the fact that the kind of symptoms that people can exhibit, you can actually, even with severe depression, you can see a wide range of symptoms. We think of depression as being something that displays as lethargy, as lack of energy, as that person who says, you know, the things that used to make me happy don't make me happy anymore. It can be something that's incapacitating. They cannot carry on with their normal life. It can lead to people thinking about suicide. It can lead to substance abuse as people self-medicate. Mm-hmm. It can also, interestingly enough, because we think of it as being something where people just don't have energy, that it can also lead to anger and you know, irritability and things that seem like they don't fit except that they do. You know, given that it can show up in all these ways and that the symptoms are kind of a continuum, I mean, how do you even draw lines between mild, moderate, and severe depression?
Right. Well, all those are good questions. You know, to do the question justice, we'd need a lot more time than we have. So let me just say briefly, you went over some of the major symptoms of what we call a major depression. Depressed mood, which is obvious enough. Decreased interest or pleasure in almost everything. Change in appetite or weight, often with profound weight loss, sometimes weight gain, sleep disturbance, feeling agitated, loss of energy, fatigue every day, feeling worthless, guilty, really self-loathing, recurrent thoughts of death or suicidal ideation. And all this needs to be present for at least 2 weeks, though many of us, well, I should say some of us think that's probably a little too short, and we might want to extend that to 3 or 4 weeks. But that's the kind of picture that we're talking about when we're talking about major depression. And I think you hit a couple of words that are very important. Incapacity, impairment, dysfunction. People who have a major depressive episode can't get out of bed. They can't go to work. They have no motivation to do anything. And this goes on and on. It's not just a day or two of being a little bummed out. Now, in that context, Medication is often, though not always, appropriate. And we do draw distinctions, mild, moderate, and severe. And we have scales that we can give, questionnaires that we can give to people. And if they're above a certain number on that scale, we can say, okay, that's moderate or that's severe depression. But those are the kinds of symptoms that we're talking about when we even consider the use of medication.
Yeah. Well, when I suppose I wonder particularly about people who maybe fall into the moderate category, and these are people who would say they certainly are experiencing these symptoms. They're still managing to live their life. They're managing to get up and go to work and and take care of family obligations and so forth, but that they say, but you know, Doc, it's really hard. Mm-hmm. And there are some days when I get up and I'm not sure that I can actually get through the day.
Right.
So can someone like that be helped by medication? And is there, I realize here I'm asking two questions at once, but is there some danger that something like that, a moderate depression like that, if nothing is done to try to help that person, can proceed to something more severe?
Well, the short answer is the kind of person you described can be helped, not necessarily with an antidepressant. Sometimes psychotherapy is appropriate. The first thing I should say, and this is why psychiatry is a specialty within medicine, within general medicine, depression can be caused by many, many different things. It can be due to some kind of bodily problems such as low thyroid function or other causes in rare cases, so that we first want to have the person worked up for medical problems, underlying medical problems that can cause depression. We then try to decide, is the depression, if it's not due to an underlying medical problem, is it acute or is it chronic? Has it been going on for 2 weeks or 2 years? That tells us important things. And is it part of a what we call unipolar illness or bipolar illness? And the two have quite different treatments. Bipolar disorder, sometimes referred to as manic depressive illness, those have very different treatments. We also talk about dysthymic disorder, which is really chronic depression that's gone on for two or more years. Usually these folks are not as immediately or seriously impaired as people who have a major depressive episode, but they've gone on and on with their depression, kind of like the person you described, sort of dragging themselves around. Sometimes they are able to function, but just barely so. So all of these distinctions and diagnostic differences have to be considered.
Our guest, let me introduce again our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Ronald Pies. He's professor of psychiatry at State University of New York, Upstate Medical University. That's in Syracuse, New York. He's also clinical professor of psychiatry at the Tufts University School of Medicine. He's also editor-in-chief of Psychiatric Times. We're talking about depression, what it is, what causes it, how people who have problems with depression can best be helped. And questions are certainly open. You've got questions for the guest. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and also email will-talk@illinois.edu. As you said a moment ago, there can be a number of, depression can have a number of causes. We certainly know that people who are experiencing crises in their life, divorce, death of a loved one, loss of a job, you know, all these kinds of major shakeups that can happen in your life can lead to depression. Other kinds of illness can lead to depression. Certainly people, for example, have problems with chronic pain. If you hurt all the time, that can be a cause of depression. And then I think we also have this sort of understanding that there is something going on in, it can be something going on with brain chemistry that maybe apart from those other things can actually lead to depression. How good is our understanding truly of what's going on in the person's head, and I mean that really in a real physical sense, that would lead to this kind of issue?
Well, I think we have an improved understanding compared to where we were 50 years ago, but we have a long way to go. First of all, you're absolutely right that depression may be related to some kind of psychosocial trigger or precipitant for some people. And I think, and we can come back to this, it's very important to distinguish between what we would call ordinary grief or sorrow or bereavement, let's say when you lose a loved one, and the picture that we get in major depression. They're two different things, although they overlap and they're tricky to sort out. But grief and bereavement are not the same things as what we discussed earlier in terms of major depression. Now, in terms of the brain chemistry, 20 or so years ago, going back even farther when I was a resident, people talked about too little in the way of certain brain chemicals that I'm sure everyone is familiar with, serotonin, norepinephrine, and so on. Mm-hmm. And, I call this the the too little joy juice hypothesis of depression. You don't have enough of this stuff in your brain, and that's why you're depressed. Well, we know that that's simplistic at best, if not downright inaccurate. And, psychiatrists are always kind of ruefully amused when they hear people say psychiatrists think that depression is due to a chemical imbalance. Well, it's much more complicated than that. We really think it's a gene-environment interaction that is also related to the person's underlying personality traits and psychological beliefs. There is almost certainly a genetic predisposition to depression, particularly in the bipolar sphere. There is something to be said about this lack of certain brain chemicals like serotonin, but we think it's more complicated than that. The latest thinking on the biology is that people who do develop major depression may be deficient in certain nerve growth factors that actually improve the connections between neurons, and we can show in certain studies that people lack some of these nerve growth factors, and that antidepressant treatment actually seems to restore some of these nerve growth factors. You can actually see changes in brain structures like the hippocampus, a part of the brain, before and after treatment. So we sometimes talk about the biopsychosocial model of depression, meaning that there are biological, psychological, and social inputs. There's certainly a genetic foundation that kind of sets the pathway for the person. And we think it's probably an interaction among all these factors, not some one little missing chemical in a person's brain.
Let's talk with a caller. We have someone in Bloomington, Illinois, to begin with on our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Yes, hi there.
Yes.
Thank you for discussing this. It's so interesting. I come from a family who various members have had bipolar, and I probably have had depression from the time I was a child and am on medication for it, and it's helped tremendously. But I have one son with autism, and I have another neurotypical son who I think is showing, well, he's definitely has OCD, but is showing signs of depression, or what I think is depression, and we're considering medicating him, but he's only 11 years old, and I'm concerned about the overall effect of antidepressants on a young brain like his.
Mm-hmm.
Our son with autism, we do have him medicated. It's helped tremendously for him, but in his case, it's more of a crucial just daily functioning thing than it is for our 11-year-old, who does well in school, but again does have OCD, and he's been in cognitive behavior therapy for that for 2 years, and it's helped a lot. But the depression has come about with Justin. I recognize it in him because of myself, but the feeling of just not liking himself, thinking that he's going to be making mistakes. So anyway, what are your thoughts about getting a child that young diagnosed and then medicating? And I'll let you talk and hang up.
Sure. Those are good questions. There is a lot of concern and a lot of controversy about treating depression in children. And let me just say, I can't give the caller medical advice, but certainly it's very important to get a specialist in child psychiatry to have a look and see what's going on with your kids. Feeling down on yourself or having low self-esteem, sometimes that's just part of growing up, and you know, it's a developmental phase that kids go through. Sometimes it really is part of a major depression or part of a bipolar disorder. And so, you know, the one piece of advice I would give anyone in the position of the caller is make sure that you get a competent, thorough workup by a specialist in child development or child psychiatry, and get a good diagnostic workup. Also, the conditions that were mentioned, obsessive-compulsive disorder, autism, depression, these are distinct conditions, and so, you know, it's important not to roll them all into the same discussion about what to do, because they have different treatment approaches. And unipolar has a different treatment approach from bipolar disorder. In unipolar depression, we tend to go with psychotherapy and or medication and or antidepressants. In bipolar disorder, we have some real concerns about antidepressants. They're necessary in some cases, but they may actually destabilize some folks who have bipolar disorder. We tend to be much more conservative using antidepressants in bipolar disorder. We tend to use mood stabilizers, medications like lithium, for example. So that's it's another reason why it's very important to get an accurate diagnosis. If you miss the boat in the first place and someone with unipolar depression is misdiagnosed as bipolar or vice versa, then you've set the stage for problems right down the line. In terms of medications for children, certainly I think we need to be very, very conservative. And by the way, I'm not a child psychiatrist, so I'm not really an expert in that area. But I do think we have to be very conservative. There is concern that prescribing for kids has increased considerably in recent years in this country. And that's certainly worrisome, though not necessarily all bad. It may be that we're recognizing more cases of depression in children and, you know, getting them appropriately treated. But in other cases, it may be that the medications are being prescribed too quickly without understanding what's going on in the family, whether there are family problems and so on that might be fixed by some kind of psychotherapy or family therapy. So the bottom line is, you know, for the caller, make sure you get a very thorough evaluation done of your kids, and ideally by someone who has expertise in child psychiatry.
Well, I hope that that's helpful for the caller. If she would like to follow up, she certainly may, and other people who are listening are welcome to call as well with their questions. We are talking about depression in this part of Focus, and our guest is Dr. Ronald Pies. He's professor of psychiatry at State University of New York, Upstate Medical University. That's in Syracuse, New York. He's also clinical professor of psychiatry at the Tufts University School of Medicine. He's also editor-in-chief of Psychiatric Times, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. This is a subject that I wanted to at least touch on, and I'm glad we've gotten there, because I think some people in the you know, counseling fields, there might have been a time maybe not all that long ago when some people would have gone as far as to argue that children can't experience depression. Mm-hmm. And now we see more and more children who are diagnosed with depression, and as you pointed out, if you look at the growth rate of prescriptions for antidepressants being written, look at where the growth rate is the fastest.
Right.
It's in children,
right.
And that's something that concerns people very much for a variety of reasons. And I guess you said that that's something that first of all, you said you're not an expert in child psychiatry. You've also said that as far as use of medication is concerned, it's something that you got to be really careful with.
Absolutely.
You don't want to rush into that. And I'm just wondering, any other thoughts you might have about now our increasing willingness to say, yes, children can experience depression, and that, in fact, it might be serious enough so that we would think about some kind of medication.
Right. Well, good questions, David. I mean, first of all, you're absolutely right that, 100 years ago, if you talked to Freudian psychoanalyst, and you asked about childhood depression, they would have sort of snickered at you and said, "Don't you understand that children are too young to have depression? They haven't developed a superego. You know, the superego is sort of like the conscience, and it kind of punishes you for doing bad things." Well, you know, the notion was that kids age 5, 6, and around that age didn't have a well-developed superego, so they couldn't really feel guilty, and so therefore they couldn't be depressed. Well, we know, and I think I can say this with a high degree of confidence, we know that that's just not the case, that children as young as 5 or 6, some people would say even younger, can develop a full-blown major depression. They can also develop bipolar disorder and have a depression in the context of bipolar illness, though there is controversy about how young the child can be before you ought to apply that diagnosis. But you're absolutely right. Even as we have recognized depression more frequently in children, we also have seen rates of prescriptions for antidepressants go up. Now, let me just mention that about 80% of prescriptions written for antidepressants in this country are not written by psychiatrists, and that's an interesting finding. Most of the prescriptions are written by primary care doctors, most of whom, and I say this with great respect for my primary practice colleagues, most of whom have not had a great deal of training in psychiatric diagnosis. They do their best, but, you know, they have 8, 10, 15 minutes to see the patient, sometimes it's easy to pick up the prescription pad and write a prescription without having delved into what's going on in the family, what's going on at school, and so on. I don't want to blame them for that. They're overworked and underpaid, and I sympathize, but you know, most prescriptions are not written by psychiatrists. Very few people who have depression, kids or adults, ever get to see a psychiatrist in this country. And on the whole, there's good evidence that depression in many settings is being underdiagnosed and undertreated. There was a study recently that showed that if you do screening tests for depression using particular sort of test questions, in a primary care setting, only about a third of patients who screen positive for depression have actually received that diagnosis from the primary care doctor. Two-thirds of the people who are depressed in their practice have not been diagnosed with it. So yes, there is overdiagnosis and overprescription, but there's also underdiagnosis and underprescription. I call it the Twin Peaks effect because you can see both.
Let's talk with some other callers, and we'll talk next with someone in Mahomet, line 1, right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have been diagnosed by a psychiatrist with moderate to severe depression, but when I first mentioned the depressive symptoms I had, I'm trying to think, about 16 years ago, it was to my primary care physician, and the first thing he did for me is give me medication for sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And that helped amazingly.
Mm-hmm.
And since that time, I've gone, eventually got referred to a psychiatrist and have been on different medications. And now the combination that's helped me the most is that I also see a therapist,
mm-hmm,
who's done dialectical behavior therapy with me, which has been wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
When my son in seventh grade developed depressive symptoms, which I realized, his doctor wouldn't, of course, give him anything for it, but he sent us to the sleep doctor.
Mm-hmm.
We have a specialist in town who does sleep disorder treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing he did to help my son is get him on medication to help him fall asleep and stay asleep.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about, you know, sleep disorders and depression,
mm-hmm,
or the inability to sleep or stay soundly asleep, and how much that adds to depression.
Yeah, that's a great question. The short answer is that there certainly is an association between sleep problems and depression, but the link is a complicated one. It comes down to this. Problem sleeping can be a symptom of depression, for sure. And, you know, we usually point to insomnia, the inability to fall asleep or stay asleep, as a classic finding in major depression. And the tip-off is often early morning awakening, where people will awaken at 3 or 4 in the morning every morning. They just cannot get back to sleep. That's classic for the finding in major depression. So insomnia and occasionally what we call hypersomnia, too much sleep, people who sleep 15, 16 hours a day, those can be symptoms of depression. On the other hand, and this may relate to your question, there are people who have an underlying sleep disorder. For example, some people have breathing problems when they sleep. We often see this in middle-aged men who are overweight, have high blood pressure. They have a syndrome called sleep apnea. Obstructive sleep apnea is the most common type, where they are almost choking during the night. Often they have very, very loud snoring. Some people say it wakes the neighbors. Those people have a primary underlying sleep disorder, and they wake up feeling just absolutely miserable, and understandably, they get depressed. And so you do have to consider the possibility of an underlying sleep disorder in the differential diagnosis of depression, particularly if there are other signs and symptoms like very, very loud snoring in a middle-aged male who has high blood pressure. That's kind of the classic picture for obstructive sleep apnea.
My son's problem was restless leg syndrome, which his father also has, and all through his junior high and high school, he was treated with just the medication for sleep, which helped greatly, plus exercise and a little bit of therapy. But now he's just out of college, and he has found that occasionally he needs antidepressive medication, you know, if he has a low period. So he doesn't get treated regularly with antidepressants, but he still does get treated for his restless leg syndrome.
Right.
And that has made all the difference in the world to him.
So well, it's a good point because we often think that depression is just kind of popping up out of the blue. Sometimes it is due to an underlying physical problem, though I hesitate to make that distinction because people sometimes then conclude that depression isn't physical, and that's not true. But an underlying neurological problem, such as restless leg syndrome or abnormal muscle contractions at night, those can lead to impaired sleep, which, as anybody knows who has gone without sleep for prolonged periods, can lead then to chronic depression, low energy. And it is important to get a good medical workup when you are depressed for long periods of time. Thyroid function is important to check. Occasionally we find people with underlying vitamin deficiencies, and there are other causes for depression that are less common. But I think your call really highlights the point that depression is a symptom. It's not a diagnosis. It's sort of like saying that your car has engine trouble. If you were told that by a mechanic, you'd say, well, what does that mean? And the same thing, if somebody, you know, gives you a diagnosis of depression and that's all they tell you, you haven't really gotten a diagnosis. You've just gotten a description of what you already know you have.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And we will go on, and we'll talk next with someone in Urbana, line number 2. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. I'm a psychologist and work with people experiencing pet loss. How do you help people distinguish between a normal grief reaction and depression, since so many of the symptoms and signs are the same?
That's a great question, and you said you're a psychologist, Doctor?
Yes.
And you, did you say pet, P-E-T, loss?
Yeah, the loss of an animal that is very, very, very special to them.
Absolutely.
You know, often described as a family member or a baby and so on.
Well, that's a great question, and it brings me back to what we started to talk about earlier, differences between grief or bereavement in the case of losing a loved one, and that sometimes can be a beloved animal, for sure. the differences between grief and bereavement on the one hand and depression on the other. This is actually a pretty hotly debated topic even among my colleagues these days. But most of us who specialize in mood disorders do recognize that grief or bereavement and major depression are separate conditions. They overlap for sure, and they're hard to disentangle, but they are separate conditions. So let's just quickly go through some of the differences. We usually think of grief as a, quote, normal, unquote, adaptive response to loss. Probably all mammalian species have some kind of grief response when they lose a loved one. And that response certainly involves sadness. It may involve a decreased appetite or problems sleeping. Usually these problems are not grossly incapacitating for the person. If you think about the time that you may have lost someone that was close to you, you may have been able to go to work, you may have been able to get up and do your chores, but you were feeling sorrow and loss. The difference between that and major depression is quite pronounced. In major depression, generally speaking, the person is incapacitated, unable to function. There is profound change in sleep and weight and appetite in major depression that goes on usually for weeks and weeks. You can see some of those things in grief, but there are some differences. For one thing, the person who is experiencing normal grief, or what I call productive grief, will often experience pleasant memories of the person or perhaps the pet that they've lost. They'll be able to reflect that, well, I'm sad now, but this will pass. I'll get out of this. They do not suffer, in most cases, a loss of self-esteem. They don't feel self-loathing for themselves. They don't feel tremendous, overwhelming guilt. They don't usually feel suicidal. These are people who are grieving. All of those things I just mentioned are reversed in major depression. People typically feel tremendous self-loathing. Their self-esteem has gone down. They often feel that this is just going to go on forever. It's never going to end. They feel like killing themselves. They feel that life is hopeless. And so we can find both external and internal differences between normal grief or grieving and major depression. Sometimes the two are hard to disentangle, especially if somebody develops a major depression after the loss of a loved one, something we call bereavement-related major depression. Then it's very tough sometimes to tease those two apart, but there are differences.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
All right. Thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. I'd like to introduce again the guest, Dr. Ronald Pies. He's professor of psychiatry at the State University of New York Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. He's also clinical professor of psychiatry at the Tufts University School of Medicine. He is also the editor-in-chief of Psychiatric Times. We're talking about depression, and questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just, I'm interested in you reflecting on the kind of thing that I think some people have said in relation to the increasing diagnosis of depression and also the increase in the numbers of people who are taking medication. And there, sometimes people look at this and they say, well, it makes them a little uncomfortable because they think that we are denying the fact that sadness and the experience of sadness is a normal part of life. It's part of the human condition. There are times when you're going to feel sad, and that by medicating it in this way, we're somehow, as I say, we're somehow denying that that is a normal, expected part of human experience.
Yes, and it's a good point, and there are a number of books out making the argument that we are medicalizing sadness or medicalizing grief. And I think that the people who take that point of view are making a valid point, but I think it's been misunderstood and misused. We all experience sadness. We all experience grief. These are normal parts of life. They're not disorders. They're not diseases. They're not conditions that require medical treatment. And to the extent that sometimes a doctor will reach for the prescription pad and write out a prescription for somebody who is experiencing normal grief or sadness, that is a real problem. On the other hand, we know that people who have a bona fide major depressive episode are often not getting treated for it. And they're not getting the care from their primary care doctor. They're not getting, they're not certainly seeing a psychiatrist. And they are not getting the appropriate treatment by way of either psychotherapy or medication. And in fact, I think that underdiagnosis and undertreatment of major depression, which, by the way, has a mortality rate due to suicide of about 4 in 100, undertreatment and underrecognition of that problem, I believe, is a bigger problem than the flip side of that, which is overtreatment of grief and sadness. Both can occur, and you know we want to be careful about that. I do think it's true that if you are feeling sad and perhaps feeling grief, and you walk into your primary care doctor's office and he or she sees you for 8 minutes and hands you a prescription, you really do need to think twice about, gee, you know, that was quick. And that can happen for sure. But it's also the case that many people who have severe major depression and who could benefit from treatment are not getting it. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's probably a larger public health problem, given the fact that major depression is a potentially lethal condition.
Well, you know, right now, and for some time now, we have been engaged in this major national conversation about health care and about access to it and the problem of access to it. And an even more serious problem is access to mental health care.
Yes.
And even people who have health insurance, they there are fairly significant limits on the amount of doctor time that they get. So, and I suppose there are also people who say that dealing with mental health issues, depression and otherwise, don't require lifelong therapy, but it may require more than, you know, a half dozen 15-minute sessions or whatever your insurance will pay for. So, I mean, I guess the question is, how do you strike the balance here and find what is a reasonable kind of expectation for what's going to be really effective therapy? How much do people need? How much can they get?
Yeah. Well, good questions. I mean, unfortunately, major depression is a highly recurrent condition. Bipolar disorder is even more highly recurrent. And so, unfortunately, many people who develop a major depressive episode once in their lives, will go on, a large percentage will go on to develop a second or a third or even more. And so those folks really do need some kind of ongoing monitoring at the very least, if not ongoing treatment. Not everybody needs lifelong treatment for their depression, but if they have a recurrence, they will need that. And you're absolutely right that our healthcare system right now is not set up to deal with those needs, particularly in minority populations. The percentage of people who have the diagnosis of depression who actually get the help they need is really depressingly small, if you'll forgive that expression. I mean, these folks are just not getting the treatment that they need. Few of them probably even see their primary care physician, much less a psychiatrist. They don't have insurance. They don't have the money to pay for it. And this is a real national public health care problem. And I think it overwhelms the issue of over-treatment of grief and sadness. I mean, I do think that that can be a problem. But I think it pales in comparison to the under-treatment of severe major depression.
We have other callers here. Let's go to Champaign, line one here. Hello.
Hi. I have a younger sister that's been diagnosed with bipolar depression, mm-hmm. and she was just diagnosed with it this past year. But she also was found to be lacking in B12 vitamins. I think it's B12. Mm. And she can't metabolize B vitamins.
Mm.
So she has to go in for a shot. I think it's like every 3 months.
Yeah, B12 shot probably.
Yeah, and is that linked to her bipolar depression? I know you mentioned minerals or certain...
Right. Well, that's a very interesting question. Sorry that your sister's going through that. Indeed, I mean, B12 deficiency, vitamin B12 deficiency, can cause depression. No question about that. And people who have, for example, pernicious anemia, have an inability to absorb vitamin B12 from their stomach, and so they do need these shots, B12 shots. I don't know if that's the case with your sister, but that's certainly one relatively uncommon cause of depression, but it can occur. I'm not aware of any direct link between that and bipolar disorder, though there may be a link there. It may be a coincidence. I mean, it's fortunate that the B12 deficiency was picked up, because sometimes people will go for years without that being recognized. So again, it's a good reminder that depression is a symptom. It's not a diagnosis. I don't know whether in your sister's case it's a coincidence or not. I'm not aware of any direct link there, but it's a very interesting question.
Yes, at the time she was also diagnosed with anemia. But once they cleared up, the B12,
right.
Then the anemia was cured.
Yes.
I was curious about that link. Thank you very much.
Sure.
All right, thank you. We're getting short on time here. We'll see if we can get one more caller. Go to Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Yes. Thank you, doctor, for using the word symptom, which is indicative of social and discombobulation. Mm-hmm. My primary question is, how do you and your brethren and sisters explain the acting out, both in ordinary society and in world society, the act of same-species murder?
Explaining violence and murder and other acts in relation to depression?
Well, not necessarily depression. That may be a symptom of a larger illness. And I think humans are the only ones who, mainly patriarchs, who design and carry out same-species murder through war, giving it a better name for the act. And under social conditions, who carry that out, and some of the symptoms you have described can lead to the conflicts that end up in same-species murder.
Well, that's a very good question. I'm probably not qualified to answer it. I think you're asking, a social, political, religious, and maybe anthropological question of why we are so violent as a species, particularly against our own species. I don't have an answer to that, and I can't relate it immediately to depression. I will say this, though. There is a connection between anger and depression, and there is a subtype of depression that can sometimes be manifest as rage attacks or anger attacks. And whether that has anything to do with why we seem to be so brutal to each other as a species, I don't know. But there is certainly a link between anger and depression. And when you treat the depression, sometimes you do see the anger actually declining. So I think that's probably the only direct connection I can make for you.
Mm. We're coming down here to a couple of minutes. Something else that we've talked about quite a bit about medication, something else I'm just interested
sure.
in your thoughts on, that for a variety of reasons, maybe people don't have access to health care. Maybe they're not inclined to talk about this with their doctor. We know that as Americans, we do have this inclination to medicate ourselves.
Right.
That may, in fact, lead, on the one hand, to substance abuse, but it also may lead people to go and look at what sort of things might be available over the counter that
right.
would be helpful.
Right.
And one thing that some people say they have found helpful is an herbal thing called St. John's wort,
right.
Which has actually been prescribed, I believe, in some places in Europe as
sure.
for cases of mild to moderate depression.
Right.
I'm wondering, do you have any experience with this or anything to say about it?
Yeah, that's a good question, David. And there are a lot of folks who will go in to their drugstore and buy either St. John's Wort or SAMe, S-denosylmethionine, and try to treat their depression. I strongly recommend against trying to sort of treat your own depression without knowing what's causing it. These over-the-counter agents can, in some cases, be effective. There is fairly decent evidence for St. John's Wort and for SAMe. However, they can also cause significant drug-drug interactions. And, for example, people who are taking immunosuppressant drugs because they've had a transplant of some sort, St. John's Wort can actually cause them to reject the organ because it interferes with the medication that they're taking to suppress their own immune response. So, you know, just because you can buy it in a drugstore doesn't mean that you should be taking it with the assumption that it's entirely safe. So all of those over-the-counter agents should be discussed with your doctor before you start treating yourself.
We are coming down to the point where we have maybe about a minute left.
Sure.
We have covered a fair amount of territory fairly quickly, so that it is a complex subject, and each individual is an individual, and their situation has to be dealt with on an individual basis. So it's maybe hard sometimes to do anything more than say engage in sweeping generalizations.
Sure.
Having said all that, though, where would you like us to finish up here?
I think the bottom line for me, David, is keep in mind that sadness and serious depression are two different things. Sure, we all get sad from time to time, but major depression is a different critter, and it really requires professional treatment. The good news is that depression, once diagnosed, is highly treatable, both with psychotherapy and, in some cases, usually in the more severe cases, with medication. And try to get help. See your primary care doctor first. And if you need a referral to a specialist, be assertive and try to get that to happen.
Well, at that, we will say thanks to our guest, Dr. Ronald Pies. He's professor of psychiatry at SUNY Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, clinical professor of psychiatry at Tufts University School of Medicine. He's editor-in-chief of Psychiatric Times. And Dr. Pies, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.